Okay, well, would you read just one verse, one long verse this morning from Canto 3, chapter 21. It's text 31. There's a very deep three-page purport. Lord Vishnu continuing, speaking to Kardama Muni. He's just finished letting Kardama Muni know that he knows his desire. He's very satisfied with his devotion. He's going to fulfill his heart's desire. And discussion has been basically twofold. He wants to fulfill the instruction of his father, Lord Brahma, to create good praja, offspring. And he has as a desire to have the Supreme Lord as his son, one of his offspring. So Lord Vishnu has said that day after tomorrow, Swayambhuva Manu and his wife, Shatarupa, will come and find you deep here in the forest, and they're going to make a request of you that you accept their daughter as your wife, and you will marry her, and there will be 9 daughters who will then be entrusted to sages. Basically, it's his 9 other brothers to marry them, and then they in turn will produce good offspring. And the last verse that we read was, with your heart cleansed by properly carrying out my command, resigning to me the fruits of all your acts, you will finally attain to me. So he's got a roadmap. He's going back to Godhead, and in between he's going to follow the Lord's instruction, which happens to be a fulfillment of a material desire. It's his material desire, but the Lord is now commanding him or instructing him how to move from Sakam Bhakti to Nishkam Bhakti, to devotional service that's mixed with material desire, to come to the position of unmixed devotion. And with our heart becoming cleansed in that way, he'll attain the personality of God, its eternal association and service. So this morning's verse showing compassion to all living entities, Kutva Dayam Cha Jiveshu, you will attain self-realization. Dattva Chabhayam Atmavan, giving assurance of safety to all, you will perceive your own self as well as all the universes in me and myself in you. So we read the verse yesterday in a little sneak preview, but it's very elaborate purport. Prabhupada is going to make reference to the verses of chapter 9 Bhagavad Gita where a similar understanding is presented. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. The simple process of self-realization for every living entity is described here. The first principle, to be understood is that this world is a product of the Supreme Will. There is an identity of this world with the Supreme Lord. The identity is accepted in a misconceived way by the impersonalists. They say that the Supreme Absolute Truth, transforming himself into the universe, loses his separate existence. Thus, they accept the world and everything in it to be the Lord. That is pantheism, wherein everything is considered to be the Lord. This is the view of the impersonalist. But those who are personal devotees of the Lord take everything to be the property of the Supreme Lord. Everything, whatever we see, is the manifestation of the Supreme Lord. Therefore, everything should be engaged in the service of the Lord. This is oneness. The difference between the impersonalist and the personalist is that the impersonalist does not accept the separate existence of the Lord, but the personalist accepts the Lord. He understands that although he distributes himself in so many ways, he has his separate personal existence. This is described in Bhagavad Gita, quote, "I am spread all over the universe in my impersonal form. Everything is resting on me, but I am not present," unquote. There is a nice example regarding the sun and the sunshine. The sun, by its sunshine, is spread all over the universe, and all the planets rest on the sunshine. But all the planets are different from the sun planet. One cannot say that because the planets are resting on the sunshine, these planets are also the sun. Similarly, the impersonal or pantheistic view that everything is God is not a very intelligent proposal. The real position, as explained by the Lord himself, is that although nothing can exist without him, it is not a fact that everything is him. He is different from everything. So, here also the Lord says, quote, "You will see everything in the world that was good while it lasted. You will see everything in the world to be non-different from me. You will see everything in the world to be non-different from me." This means that everything should be considered a product of the Lord's energy, and therefore, everything should be employed in the service of the Lord. One's energy should be utilized for one's self-interest. That is the perfection of the energy. So that's one third of the purport so far. It's very rich and deep purport. The section of Bhagavad Gita where this same understanding is presented is chapter 9. And chapter 9, what's the title of chapter 9? Most Confidential Knowledge. So, what's the most confidential? What's confidential knowledge? Knowing the soul. Immersed within matter, there is a soul, and that's us. Confidential. More confidential is there's a distinction between the individual soul and the Supreme Soul, both who are situated within the body and animating the body and directing the activities. Supersoul is. And the most confidential knowledge is the relationship of the individual soul to the Supreme Soul, specifically devotional service to the Supreme Soul. So when Krishna introduces this understanding, chapter 9, he begins the real big build-up before he starts speaking. This is Rajavija Rajaguyam Pavitram Idam Uttamam Pratyakshava Avgamam Dharmam Susukam Kartam Avyayam, and then says that faithless persons aren't going to understand this. And that way it's confidential. So confidential knowledge, most confidential knowledge requires faith. And then he begins speaking this most confidential knowledge. That's, when you just read the verses, it's bewildering. I mean, it's bewildering. What's he saying? I'll read the verses. Same verses, text 4, chapter 9. It's 4, 5, and 6. The beginning part. By me in my unmanifested form, by me in my unmanifested form, this entire universe is pervaded. All beings are in me. But I am not in them. What's he saying? And yet everything that is created does not rest in me. Behold my mystic opulence. Although I am the maintainer of all living entities, and although I am everywhere, I am not a part of this cosmic manifestation, for myself is the very source of creation. Text 6. Understand that as the mighty wind blowing everywhere rests always in the sky, all created beings rest in me. That was interesting. What did he say? And what does he wish for us to understand? And what's the utility or the purpose of that understanding? And it's the same as what Lord Vishnu was saying to Karnama. When you achieve this state that he said he would achieve, here's what you're going to understand. Well, first mentioned is you'll be filled with compassion. So more on that later. That's what you'll feel towards all living entities. And how you'll regard me is that all living entities, as well as yourself, as well as all the universes, are in me. And myself in you. So that makes one a pretty big self. Like inside yourself is the Supreme Lord, within whom are you and all living entities and the entire, all the universes. That's a pretty big self. I mean, that's big. Mahavishnu is the generator of unlimited universes. And how big is a universe? Like we hear from scripture. Come on in. We hear from scripture that this universe is relatively small compared to some. Our Lord Brahma only has four heads. Only. But some universes it's 10 heads, 100 heads, 1,000 heads, 10,000 heads, 100,000 heads. He's got a big universe to look after. And what's the diameter? 4 billion miles? 4 billion miles? And the coverings of the universe are 10 times, in 7 layers, each 10 times greater than the previous one. Sariputta did a calculation of, on scale, if the universe is the size of a pea, the coverings of the universe are 3,000 miles. But it's 4 billion miles, different scale. Tamal Krishnamurti was describing that once Prabhupada, to help his disciples understand, like, the universes, he had them get pieces of paper and spread them out on the floor. And, you know, here's the universe and here's the coverings of the universe. And they ran out of floor space. So he said, you know, do it on a smaller scale. But, you know, even if the universe is the size of a pea, you have to go 3,000 miles, he said, is like from Delhi to Calcutta. You have to have a big room. Or a very small universe. And those universes, in the seed form, they're within the pores of Mahavishnu's skin or body. He's big. Of course, they're seed and they expand, and then as they expand, they enter into the expanding means, rather, they enter into the Mahatattva as he breathes out, and then the, according to the Bhagavatam description and Sri Brahma Samhita's description, the elements begin to cluster around the seed and enlarge the seed. Well, it's, you know, big covering, but the inside is the seed of the universe. And that's even before Garbhadakshay Vishnu enters within each universe. It just starts to enlarge. So that's Mahavishnu, who's a portion of a plenary portion of Krishna. And we're hearing Vishnu saying to Kardava Muni that when you achieve this state of purification, where you're so pure and qualified that you'll abide with me always, here's what you're going to experience: coming attractions, compassion for all living entities, and you'll see all living entities and yourself and all the universes in me, and I'm within you. So, like Mahavishnu. And the living entity is 1/10,000th the size of the tip of a hair. So it's double talk, right? It's the inconceivable potency of the personality of Godhead. Anor anyang samanusmaret yaha. He's smaller than the smallest and bigger than the biggest at the same time. Not, okay, I'm really small, then I'm going to get really big, then I'm going to become really small, then get really big. You know, collapsible Vishnu. It's simultaneously. It's inconceivable potency. Everything is resting in me. So that's the verse, that's text 6, which Prabhupada is paraphrasing here, which he says is what, same thing as what Vishnu is saying. Understand, oops, text 4. By me, in my avyakta murti, my unmanifested form, this entire universe is pervaded. So there are different ways of understanding what the unmanifested form what that is. Different ways of understanding it. And it's, so the whole universe is resting in this unmanifested form. So he gives a metaphor to help us understand. It's like the sky. And within the sky, there's the mighty wind. But it's resting in the sky. The sky is more subtle, elements-wise. And then there's air, earth, water, fire, air, and sky. So sky, and then air, then fire, then water, and earth. Whoops. Sky, air, water. No, fire, water, earth. Yeah. So the subtle element can include the grosser element. So let's say here is some sky that has some air, and here is some sky that doesn't have any air. You know, like I remember in eighth grade science class, our teacher put on the table, the front table, a bell jar. We didn't know what a bell jar was. Real thick glass. And he put a vacuum pump and hooked it up and started it up really noisy and then pumped all the everything out of the bell jar. Then he asked what's inside. And you're supposed to say nothing, because every solids, liquids, and gases have been pumped out. So what's inside? It's a vacuum. Nothing. It's not nothing, it's sky. Well, you know, but that's nothing. No, it's something. It's an energy of Krishna. And as the sky, as an energy of Krishna, contains within it, whether it's a bell jar with, you know, no liquid solids and gases inside, or you put some gas inside, or some air, or some moisture, or some solids, it doesn't displace the sky, it's still sky. It's pervasive. There's sky, you know, on this side of the solid and that side of the solid and within the solid. The solid is resting within the sky. And the vapor, water vapor, and the air, it's all resting within the sky. So because it's more subtle, everything's resting within it. But the sky has its own existence, not dependent upon what's in it. It's independent of what's in it. You can put something in it. So similarly, Krishna is the Avyaktamurti, is that in which everything rests. But the Avyaktamurti, or Krishna, what to speak of as unmanifested form, Krishna has his independent existence. He's not dependent. He's independent. And therefore, he says, and yet everything that is created does not rest in me, meaning, so it does rest in him, but he has his own independent existence. Let's go to, you know, Krishna Loka and see if Krishna has inside him some, you know, some sky or some water. He has independent existence, and yet those existences are dependent upon him. And he's independent. Behold my mystic opulence. Although I am the maintainer of all living entities, so this is going back to what Vishnu was saying to Kardama Muni, although I am the maintainer of all living entities, and although I am everywhere, he's expanded by his Avyaktamurti, and he's expanded in a number of ways, by his potencies. His potencies are everywhere. Is there some place where there's no potency? Prabhupada said it like this. There are two things. There's Krishna, and there's Krishna's, and there's not a third thing. There's no void in creation. Void would mean nothing. There's something, and then there's the absence of something, which is nothing. So what is it that, what is the goal? I've learned this from my visits to China. I kind of had to learn it. Well, I didn't have to learn it. What's the goal of Buddhism? Nirvana. That's, you know, the Sanskrit. And so what is that? It's nothingness. What an aspiration. Besides, it's impossible. There's no such thing of nothingness. It's born of exactly as Prabhupada says in Bhagavad Gita, Vitaragavaya Krodha. It's born of frustration. Oh, it's so much misery. And it is so much misery from a material perspective. So let me get rid of this misery. Where do I go to get rid of this misery? Go to nothingness. Because where there's somethingness, it's miserable. So I'll go to nothingness. Negation. And that's their goal. Go to nothingness. So you have to negate the somethingness to get to nothingness. That's their process. Impersonalist, it's philosophical. Neti neti. Not this, not this, not this. And back yourself in a corner. So what's real? Well, it's not this. Definition by negation. So it's vimuktamaninas. It's imagined. Vimukti maninas. Imagine within the mind liberation. I'm one with Brahman. I am Brahman. I am God. So what is God? God is Brahman. And what's this? Well, this is a transformation of Brahman. God lost his godhood. He just became this. And then, you know, just consolidated back together again, and you're God. In that fact, I'm God. Just ask me. And you're God too. So we'll but you just have to say this is false. You have to go there and say it doesn't exist. Brahman Satya Jagat Mithya. It's false. Just give it a bad name and now you're God. Pretty simple. It's a conceptualized or a notional sense of oneness. But it's a very popular one. Very popular. And, you know, big scholarly people really like it. Because there's, you know, the hint is they want to be God. So they use their intellect to construct an idea that says they're God. I was just listening yesterday morning to a morning walk conversation in Juhu Beach with Dr. Patel and Srila Prabhupada. He was a scientist who had read a lot of books on spirituality along with the science books. And it was a pretty heated discussion about it's all one, no, it's not all one. Prabhupada gave like 20 different examples why it's not so. But, you know, he had like bought into the whole program of it's all one. So he wasn't, and he had like intellectual tools to like disagree and, you know, hold the other position of it's all one. And it's specific to this discussion here. Since everything, it's the pantheist view. Since everything comes from God, everything's God. Since everything, it's inseparable, and therefore it's also God. Pantheism. And if you look pantheism up in the dictionary, like I've done it a couple times, there's this. One idea of pantheism is to see nature as God. The trees are God and the mountains are God. And there's certainly a sense of awesomeness and power within nature when you, you know, disconnect from artificial life and get involved in the awesomeness of nature. It's awesome. It, you get a sense of power. Power. Whew. God. The presence of God. I met somebody when I was visiting in Arizona, and they said they moved from where they had previously lived to Arizona because they had this, like, inspiration they would find God in the desert. Yeah, did you find him? But there's a sense of mightiness of the presence of God within the desert or the mountains or just the forces of nature, the mightiness of God. But there's another meaning besides God is nature, or nature is God. It's another idea of pantheism, is the controllers of nature. Like polytheism is another practically equivalent of pantheism. So they're connected. Meaning, many gods. So pantheism often is taken to mean many gods. Besides God is nature, many gods make up God. This one is God, that one is God. And, you know, the generic Hinduism idea. Many gods. Without recognizing the background, you know, like this verse, that all the living entities are resting in me. So the living entities that are powerful, and the universes, the forces of nature, emanate from the Supreme. So what do you do if you're an impersonalist? You just dissolve the Supreme. Like, you know, the Brahman transforms itself into this. So this is Brahman. And there are devatas. So you know, worship this devata, that's fine, because in the ultimate issue, it's all one. Behind the many, it's all one. That's why they're all God, because all there is Brahman. So whether it's this one or that one or the other one, you know, worship whatever you want. What's your favorite? And it like they speak like that. But behind it all is impersonal. So Prabhupada is helping us in this one paragraph to not misunderstand or to see clearly the difference between how an impersonalist sees and how a personalist sees. So for that reason, one of the translations that Prabhupada made of the Upanishads was Isha Upanishad, where it's explicitly clear. I mean, Isha Upanishad, becoming nearer to Isha. So Om Purnamada Purnamidam. So from the Supreme, so many emanations come from the Supreme, each of which, as he is Purna, they are Purna. Hey, if you're an impersonalist, that sounds, everything is God. But that original from which everything is transformed isn't diminished. 1 - 1 = 1. Interesting mathematics. When that one is the Supreme. And since everything comes from him, then the next one, it belongs to him. And then you utilize those things that belong to him. It's proprietorship. The source is the proprietor. But so it's personal. He's a person. And the energies come from him. So this is how a devotee sees. The energies come from him. that are inseparable from him, and therefore they should be used in his service. Doesn't Krishna say that in Bhagavad Gita? 10.8 Bhagavad Gita. Aham sarvasya prabhavo matak sarvam pravartate iti matva bhajante mam. Thus knowing that everything that exists, matter and spirit and everything, just as is being said here, the living entities and the universes, matter and spirit, everything, rests in me. Thus knowing what engages in his devotional service. So, or the other way around, engage in devotional service and you now have the connection, the link with the Supreme to understand the relationship of all things with the Supreme. Not that everything is the Supreme or that everything is false. You know, go to this extreme or that extreme. It's not seeing things properly according to what Vishnu is saying to Kardava Muni and what Krishna is saying to Arjuna. It's not false and it's not the Supreme, but it's inseparable from the Supreme, and therefore it is to be used in his service. So Prabhupada quotes here, this text 31 from the Bhagavatam, the Lord is saying to Kardama, quote, "You will see everything in the world to be non-different from me." There's the oneness. You'll see everything in the world, living entities and matter, to be non-different from me. In the sense that both, in chapter 7 it's described, matter and spirit are both prakriti. They're energy. And he's the Purusha, the master of and the enjoyer of his prakriti. And they're two different things. But impersonalists don't like that. You can't have two different things, prakriti and Purusha. Why not? Well, because it's all one. So you just like dismiss them. There's only one thing. Matter is false, and all there is Brahman. But that's not what Krishna says. But that's what they say Krishna says. But that's not what Krishna says. And not only there's matter and spirit, but there's the controller of both. Once Prabhupada said, Krishna consciousness is very simple. I am very small and God is very great, and therefore I should serve him. That is Krishna consciousness. Very simple. But if I want to think, no, I'm great, so then I'm Brahman, but I'm this little tiny thing, how can I be Brahman? Well, just like have God disappear and then you're great. Poor God. God falls into Maya. Like me, I fell into Maya. So wait a minute, how did that happen? If I'm God, how did I fall into Maya? Well, here's the, like, watch the shell game. It's false. It's not only illusion, it's just false. You didn't fall. Wait a minute. Do that one again. Yeah, because all there is Brahman. And then, well, what's this? Is this Brahman? No, this is false. And I got covered by false. How'd that happen? No, it didn't happen. Wait a minute. It's an answer. It's a question they don't have an answer to. And they may say something, but it's not. It's just word juggling. That's, you watch the shell game, and it's a shell game. There's no answer to that question. One of several, but a very important one. So the oneness we're hearing is the interest of the Supreme. Let's see, here we go. Everything, whatever we see, is the manifestation of the Supreme Lord. Therefore, everything should be engaged in the service of the Lord. That is oneness. The real problem, as explained by the Lord Himself, is that although nothing can exist without Him, it is not a fact that everything is Him. Is italicized. He is different from everything. Next paragraph. Well, we're one third of the way through. I don't know if we're going to finish. It's a nice purport. This energy, like Prakriti, can be utilized for self-interest, for real self-interest, if one is compassionate. Wow, that's a nice sentence. Because self-interest means like for me, but real self-interest is compassion for all living entities. So, in other words, you act as an instrument of the Supreme. That's your real self-interest. Be situated in your constitutional position as a servant of the Supreme. Act as His instrument, whatever His will is. You do that. And His will is the well-being of all living entities. That's your real self-interest, being compassionate. I'm going to speak about that this evening at the temple a little bit more. So I won't go into it right now. A person in Krishna consciousness, a devotee of the Lord, is always compassionate. He is not satisfied that only he himself is a devotee, but he tries to distribute the knowledge of devotional service to everyone. There are many devotees of the Lord who faced many risks in distributing the devotional service of the Lord to the people in general. That should be done. Paragraph. Really nice. This is going to get into a preaching mood here. It is also said that a person who goes to the temple of the Lord and worships with great devotion, but who does not show sympathy to people in general or show respect to other devotees, is considered to be a third class devotee. The second class devotee is he who is merciful and compassionate to the fallen soul. The second class devotee is always cognizant of his position as an eternal servant of the Lord. He therefore makes friendships with the devotees of the Lord and acts compassionately toward the general public in teaching them devotional service and refuses to cooperate or associate with non-devotees. As long as one is not compassionate to people in general in his devotional service, he is a third-class devotee. The first-class devotee gives assurance to everyone, to every living being, that there is no fear of this material existence. Quote, "Let us live in Krishna consciousness and conquer the nations of material existence," unquote. Now he gets specific about Kardamba's he's about to enter the Grihastha Ashram. It's a nice advice for those who are about to enter Grihastha Ashram or are already in it. Paragraph. It is indicated here that Kardamba Muni was directed by the Lord to be very compassionate and liberal in his householder life and to give assurance to the people in his renounced life. So that was, he's just referring to that other sentence I just read. Because he's going to accept the renounced order of life later, giving reassurance to people. What's that? Let us live in Krishna consciousness and conquer the nations of material existence. A sannyasi, he's moving quickly. He went like, from before he's married, now he's a sannyasi. a sannyasi. One in the renounced order of life is meant to give enlightenment to the people. He should travel, going from home to enlighten. The householder, by the spell of Maya, becomes absorbed in family affairs and forgets his relationship with Krishna. If he dies in forgetfulness, like the cats and dogs, then his life is spoiled. It is the duty of a sannyasi, therefore, to go and awaken the forgetful souls with enlightenment of their eternal relationship with the Lord, and to engage them in devotional service. The devotee should show mercy to the fallen souls, and also give them assurance of fearlessness. As soon as one becomes a devotee of the Lord, he is convinced that he is protected by the Lord. Fear itself is afraid of the Lord. Therefore, what has he, that's like the devotee, to do with fearfulness? Now he speaks about grihasthas. To award fearlessness to the common man is the greatest act of charity. A sannyasi, or one who is in the renounced order of life, should wander from door to door, village to village, from town to town, from country to country, all over the world as far as he is able to travel, and enlighten the householders about Krishna consciousness. A person who is a householder but is initiated by a sannyasi has the duty to spread Krishna consciousness at home. As far as possible, he should call his friends and neighbors to his house and hold classes in Krishna consciousness. Holding class means, like really, he speaks very explicit, chanting the holy name of Krishna and speaking from Bhagavad Gita or Srimad Bhagavatam. There are immense literatures for spreading Krishna consciousness, and it is the duty of each and every householder to learn about Krishna from his sannyasi spiritual master. There is a division of labor in the Lord's service. The householder's duty is to earn money, because a sannyasi is not supposed to earn money, but is completely dependent on the householder. The householder should earn money by business or by profession, and spend, here we go, at least 50% of his income to spread Krishna consciousness. 25% he can spend for his family, and 25% he should save to meet emergencies. This example was shown by Rupa Goswami, so devotees should follow it. One of the services that I'm involved with is organization development. Just back up. Going back to 2007, not so long ago, keep it simple, we started strategic planning, like, what do we want the future to be? So, here's how it started. A number of our GBC members left their bodies. Bhakti Tirtha Swami, Tamal Krishna Maharaj, Sridhar Maharaj, and the executive committee chairman was looking around thinking, you know, we're all getting a little older. We're not going to be around for forever. So, is there something we should be doing in these final days before we're gone and leave a stronger, better ISKCON? So he called for a special meeting. It's within the bylaws of the GBC. There can be special meetings, and it's, it has its only. There've only been something like 5 or 6, and usually it's like a crisis situation, and then they call it an emergency meeting. So this wasn't like a crisis, but like really important, so we had a meeting. And it was in Italy. It was really nice in the summer, and all the GBC members attended. And the first day was spent asking the following question and, you know, discussing it. As GBC members, we have a responsibility for our zone. Zonal responsibility. Do we have a responsibility for the world? And if so, what is it? And a whole day, day's discussion, like a lot of discussion, kind of free-flowing discussion, and then we decided, or the facilitator decided, go around the room and ask everybody what they think is our global responsibility. And in short, it was like a big question mark. We don't know. We know we're supposed to be doing something, but what that something is, question mark. And the day ended like very unhappy. And I know I hardly slept. And if you take the mandate seriously, you don't know what you're supposed to do. Yikes. So the next day was much better. We did one of those brainstorming things. You know, somebody got out the flip chart and said, okay, well, let's just gather ideas of what global things we should be doing. And it got like 15 pages worth of stuff. So we got a good long list. Let's see, you know how you do these things. Let's see if there are groups. And we ended up with like 7 or 8 groups of things. They all fit into those 7 or 8 groups. And that took most of the day. And then toward the end of the day, it was, okay, let's spend the next day discussing these 7, 8 things. And please identify which one of these groups you'd like to be part of. So the things that we came up with included a constitution. Prabhupada said in the 1970s, you should have a constitution. Did you know we don't have a constitution? Even today, we don't have a constitution. So some persons said, I'm going to be part of that. Akshesha took in charge because he's a lawyer and, you know, he's very good at conceptual things. Expanding the preaching, so that was another one. Book distribution. Devotee care, real important. Succession of leaders. Like, you know, some were dropping off, and what's the plan? And then we're all gone, what's the plan? So we need a succession committee. And then there's another one that there's now, it took 7 years, but there's now a formal paper that's been adopted that learning it is going to become, I mean, learning it, having questions asked on the subject is going to be part of the requirements for future initiates. And that's lines of authority, harmonizing lines of authority. It's a nice sounding idea. But we in the course of our discussion understood that during Prabhupada's time it was very simple. He was at the top. And he's still at the top, but he was the guru at the top, and so spiritual authority was all in his hand, and the managerial authority was all in his hand. And he created a GBC during his lifetime and then mandated in his will they should be the ultimate managing authority for ISKCON. But then, after his departure, then there were gurus who also have spiritual authority. And scripturally, it's undeniable. There's spiritual authority of the spiritual master and the disciple. Now we have some large number of spiritual masters. And where do they fit in that line of spiritual authority and the governance authority that Prabhupada created? How do you work it out? If you don't figure it out and just let it go over time, it'd be chaos. You know, I mean, different varieties of chaos simultaneously. So some very thoughtful persons said, yeah, I think this is really important, I'd like to be part of that group. So fast forward over time, we had additional meetings. It was decided at that summer 2007, when we have our annual general meeting, everything has to have an acronym these days, so it's an AGM, annual general meeting in Mayapur, the Mayapur meeting, 3 days more of strategic, and in between the summer 2007 and the next AGM, those committees should work out and then, you know, be prepared to meet face-to-face. So by conference calls, and you know how people do things when they're in different locations. They worked on things, and so then it came to this thinking into the future. We need to plan our future. So let's just imagine that, you know, when Prabhupada was present, there were, you know, the famous number is 108 temples. I don't know exactly how many, but 108 temples. You want to guess how many temples there are? Not just preaching centers and namahata things, but temples where there's deities and formal deity worship in the world. 560 plus all the other centers, like, you know, what you're planning to do over here. That's not a temple, it's a preaching center. And one day it'll become a temple, but so 500 and so. Let's imagine over the next 25, 30 years, there's 1,000 or 1,500 temples in the world. What's the structure on top supposed to look like? Do we have 500 GBC members? Do we keep, you know, the same number? So when we get together, it's not like in a football stadium. How do you have dialogue and work things out? You know, what's it going to look like? And then what's the structure under that to make it all nicely organized? So, you know, another committee was formed called Organization Development Committee. And I forgot the reason that I was explaining all of this, just to give you the history. That's something that I'm part of, this organization. So it's some GBC members, some non-GBC members, some temple presidents, some people that aren't even officers in ISKCON, they're just like smart people. They're part of this organization development committee. And let me look at the purport, see if I... Oh, yeah. One of the things that has the Constitution Committee stuck is membership. We've been at it for 5 years. We can't come to some consensus about membership, like who is a member. Is it initiated devotees? That's one idea. Is it people who financially contribute? That's another idea. Is it people who in their hearts say, I'm a devotee? Who's a member? Or, I love Prabhupada. Who's a member? You know, there's like ideas all over the place. Commonly, not like we have to do what's common, but commonly, members of an organization are people who contribute. They're a member. You know, like a card-carrying member of the Asia Society or whatever it is. They contribute something. Now they have an annual membership. So is that the model that we want? So in this Organization Development Committee, we started going down, well, maybe at least we should get some idea of what a member in good standing should do, whether they're, you know, that's the criterion for membership or not. So then we got to this 50% thing. And so, question, what does it mean? And question, who's going to decide what it means? Question, should the GBC have some thoughtful dialogue on what it means? So we've been having some thoughtful dialogue about what it means, the 50%. Yeah, it's been, you know, very interesting. Not consensus, but very interesting. some say different things. Well, this was Rupa Goswami when he retired. But Prabhupada's not saying he retired. He's here in this purport. It's you're grihastha, 50%. Yikes. Well, maybe it's 50% that's your discretionary funds after you take care of necessities. Not only like after taxes, but after necessities, 50%. Maybe that's what it means. I'm just letting you know, it's not clear. Lots of discussion, very thoughtful, experienced members of our society, some of whom are householders themselves, some of whom follow the 50% of their gross income rule. Some actually follow that rule. 50% of their gross income is for ISKCON, or the cause of spreading Krishna consciousness, which Prabhupada is saying here. I'm not going to entertain any questions on that topic. I'm just letting you know that we're working on it. And you should be thinking about it. You know, well, I don't know, what should it be? Okay. Last paragraph. Yet, one should not conclude that because he, Krishna, is spread all over, he has lost his personal existence. To refute such an argument, the Lord says, I am everywhere and everything is in me, but still I am aloof. This is the 9th chapter of Bhagavad Gita. For example, a king heads a government. Whoops, this is Bhagavad Gita. Here we go. We'll go back to this. Actually, to be one with the Supreme Lord means to be one with the interest of the Lord. Becoming one with the Supreme Lord does not imply becoming as great as the Supreme Lord. It is impossible. The part is never equal to the whole. The living entity is always a minute part. Therefore, his oneness with the Lord is that he is interested in the one interest of the Lord. The Lord wants every living entity to always think about him, to be his devotee and always worship him. This is clearly stated in Bhagavad Gita, Manmana Bhavamad Bhakto. Krishna wants everyone always to think of him. Everyone should always offer obeisances to Krishna. This is the will of the Supreme Lord, and devotees should try to fulfill his desire. Since the Lord is unlimited, his desire is also unlimited. There is no stoppage, and therefore, the service of the Lord, the service of the devotee, is also unlimited. We're limited. But service is unlimited. In the transcendental world, there is unlimited competition between the Lord and the servitor. The Lord wants to fulfill his desires, capital H, unlimitedly. And the devotee also serves him to fulfill his, Krishna's, unlimited desires. There is an unlimited oneness of interest between the Lord and his devotee. Just going back now, Vishnu is saying to Kardama, that day will come when you, Kardama, will complete your grihastha life and you'll become a fully enlightened individual, even in grihastha life, and then enter into your sannyas life. And while in that situation, whether grihastha life, sannyas life, this is what you're going to experience. And just to again connect with our discussion yesterday, to go from sakkama to nishkam bhakti. Here's Kardama. It's like really interesting. Like Lord Brahma, it's very clear in Brahma Samhita, Lord Brahma has a material desire. Because he asks about it at the very end, what do I do about this material desire? I want to create a universe. And Kardama has a material desire, I want a wife. I want to have children. It's a mature desire. How to go from Satkam to Nishkam Bhakti, and it's very, very relevant. And do it properly, and as he says here, your heart will become cleansed, and in that cleansed condition, you'll be fully purified and you'll abide with me always, eternally. And then this is what you're going to experience. Compassion. All living entities and yourself and all the universes are in me, like this Avyaktamurti. And I am in you. Like intimate. That's this last paragraph, the last section. The oneness of love. Any discussion? Yes.
Thank you, Maharaj. One quick question about the unmanifested form of the Lord.
Yeah.
There is a lot of discussion nowadays in science. You know, the material universe is only 5%, and there is 95% of dark energy. It's kind of, you know, they came up with that terminology because they don't know what to call that energy. So is this unmanifested form of the Lord, can we kind of relate to that unknown energy?
Meaning they're just your question is they're just giving it the wrong name? It's really the Avyaktamurti, it's not the black energy. Is that what you're asking?
Yeah.
Is there a one-to-one correlation between
them? Yeah.
That's what you're asking?
Yeah.
Not really.
Let's look for what Prabhupada writes here.
I'd like to, you know, to give a proper answer, I'd like to very carefully look at our Acharya's commentaries to see how they define this Avyaktamurti. Here's what Prabhupada writes in the purport. Here it is said that although he is all-pervading, everywhere present, he is not conceivable by the material senses. So it's Krishna speaking. He's not conceivable by, not his, you know, invisible matter. It's he. And he's with spiritual form. And within that spiritual form is everything. Although some of it is manifest, it's his spiritual form, which to material senses is not perceivable. They may see something, but they're not going, like seeing the deity. They're not going to see Krishna as Lord Chaitanya saw Krishna. That kind of not perceivable by the material senses. This is indicated here by the word of Avyaktamurti. But actually, although we cannot see him, personal, everything is resting in him, Avyaktamurti. But that's one perspective or one rendering of what Avyaktamurti is. Without reading the commentary, I can't say for sure, but I wouldn't be surprised if there are other renderings of what does that Avyaktamurti mean. He gives in verse 6, this is verse 4, in verse 6 he gives the metaphor of the sky in which the mighty wind is blowing. And similarly, all things rest in me, the Avyaktamurti. So that which is subtle, subtler than that which is grosser, the subtler is the resting place of the grosser. So he's the supreme subtle. He's where everything is. But it's not just, you know, dark matter. you know, the forces of nature they can't figure out. Something that I read in a science journal, you probably know much more about this since it sounds like you're a scientist, but it was the New York Times a number of years ago, but it's as best as I can remember, the theory that gravity is caused by mass, and what holds the universe together is gravity caused by mass. Their calculations show that something like 70% of mass is missing. They can't find it, which is sounds like what you're saying. So they stick to the, rather than let you go, there must be wrong, something wrong with the model that says everything is held together by mass and gravitational field from mass. We just can't find 70% of it. Instead of supposing there's, you know, some mass we just can't find, we, you know, it's somewhere but we can't find it, maybe the theory has to be reconsidered. Maybe there's something else that holds everything together in place besides gravity, the force of attraction between mass. And this article, which was, you know, written by a scientist, was advocating we need to look at another model and kind of spoofing at the fact that they don't. They're like stuck to, we got to make the model work, so we just say there's 95% we can, now it's, and then it was 70, now it's 95% we can't find. So black matter and, you know, black holes and just like, you know, and all of that theoretical physics and stuff. It's cute, but it's like, really? Anyway, so it's not the same. Avyaktamurti is not the same as black matter, as far as I can understand. Okay? Yes?
Maharaj, actually, the contradiction that Krishna is talking, same lines, Avyaktamurti. I mean, all the beings are in me, but I am not in them. Still, I am aloof. So, can we presume in the form of Brahman?
In the form of?
Brahman.
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 Yeah, Brahman.
Brahman.
Yeah,
Brahman.
Yes?
So, okay.
All the living entities are in Krishna and he, in his unmanifested form as Brahman.
That's a possible, I mean, I looked at it. So before looking at it, I was thinking Avyaktamurti may mean Brahman and everything is resting in Brahman. But that's not what he says. So could it be? To answer your question, I would like to look at the commentaries of the Acharyas rather than say, yeah, it could be. Or no, it couldn't be. Because we follow, not in our mind, perhaps maybe. Prabhupada didn't like perhaps maybe. So I'd like to look at the commentary of the Acharyas and see if there's something along those lines. Okay? Yes.
Thank you so much for your lecture. I know that you said that you wouldn't answer questions on this topic, but I do have a plea for you.
All right.
Please.
When we do get it worked out, I'll let you know.
Okay.
Go ahead.
The plea is this. I've known you for an incredible amount of time. I feel like I'm so blessed to have you in my life, so I want to thank you so much. The one question that I have for you is that when a personality comes into ISKCON, I started my journey to actually know you in starting in Portland. I traveled to Baltimore. And as part of Baltimore, I was asked there, please give X amount to the temple. Then I'm also connected with Colorado. And then it's Prabhu, please. And in three different occasions, I've walked into meetings where people are talking and they're saying, oh, you know, he doesn't give here. He doesn't give here. He only gives here. And so what happens is because everywhere you go, people ask, and then there's a huge guilt complex that starts up. I'm sure I'm not the only one. But what happens is that in your giving, you start giving just randomly and without a focus. And what happens is that it becomes out of guilt rather than a mode of goodness.
No good.
And so the question is, can you humbly, I ask you humbly, is it possible for that to be organized? Where one person isn't just constantly approached at all times? Because what happens is, because there's so much guilt that is associated with not giving, well, especially when a devotee asks, is there a way to organize it?
I'm taking your question seriously and trying to consider. Two thoughts are coming out prominently. To institutionalize a free will act that may one day be this and another day be that seems very contrived.
Okay. Is there some central pool where you can just send the money so that, and then you guys figure it out? You know, and that way that there's one central, or is that the contrived thought?
No. That's possible, but speaking, that should also be optional. Meaning, matters of the heart are matters of the heart. So, if there is such a facility as what you described, it's not that. Therefore, everybody in ISKCON has to do that. Okay, but now you're not saying that. You're saying, so I can get rid of this like pressure. Is that possible? Yeah, that's possible.
Or is the onus rest on the personality themselves?
Well, it's like, right? what you're suggesting is what the Mormons do. Where do the Mormons give? They have a model. It's tithing, and 10% of their gross income goes to Salt Lake. That's it. If you want to be a Mormon in good standing, 10% of your gross income. If you want to be married in the Mormon church, if you want to be, have that status of a Mormon in good standing, 10% of your gross income. You don't give here and there and the other places. You go one place, and then they divide it up. And because I've talked with their people, like, how do you do it?
Seems off to me.
And because they have consolidated funding, they describe there's definite advantages. When we buy carpeting, we buy a big bunch of carpeting, and then we get a low price, and then some carpeting over here and over there, and then there's new temples or new churches or whatever they call them. And so, we decide, and we just give a chunk over there for, so much of percentage, and then there's a committee that decides where it goes. And it's not a big committee. It's not, they hold a lot of power. And they decide where it goes. And so much for, overseas and third world countries. So that's centralized. Prabhupada did not like. There was an idea once upon a time of some, brilliant members of ISKCON, leaders in ISKCON, who had that idea, and they started cooking up the idea without talking to Prabhupada, and Prabhupada found out about it and blasted him. Don't do that. He wanted the model of individual initiative. So now there's this individual initiative model, and all over the place there's people with individual initiative, which is what our founder Acharya wanted, and somebody over here and over there and over there. And then there's this, I'm feeling guilty because I like to do everything, but I can't do everything. I don't have an unlimited resource. So part of that then could, to work within the model of individual initiative, one is... You just put in the one spot, and a few people can figure it out, and that's fine. Or whoever figures it out, fine. And another is I make my own free will decisions. And then at the end of the day, I'm smiling because I did what I wanted to do. And then somebody else says, and you with a big smile, my discretionary funds are all spoken for. And, you know, I'm really happy with what I've done. And I'd like, you know, that's an alternative plan to your suggestion, but I'll give some thought and discuss with others about this one. And I'm sure that it would be a lively discussion about, well, is that really what Prabhupada wanted? Kind of thing. But hey, if our members are saying this, please, maybe it's something that could be entertained. I mean, anyway, we can speak some more. Anything else?
This statement the soul is 1/10,000 of the hair, it's sometimes confusing because, like, as we move from gross matter to subtle matter, it becomes immeasurable, right? When you reach intelligence and false ego, it reaches to a stage where it is immeasurable. Then we are talking about something even more subtler, and then a statement comes that it is measurable, whatever small size it is. That's confusing, isn't it?
No. Let's take subtler matter, grosser matter, subtler matter. The Vedic concept of atoms, because you can say an atom of this or not an atom of that, different kinds of matter. The smallest indivisible, this is what I've understood what an atom is. The Vedic conception is the smallest divisible. You can't divide matter any smaller than that. That's what an atom is, the Vedic conception of atom. So it's still a particle. You know, then you get into, you know, is it a particle or wave kind of discussion. But thinking of it as a particle rather than a particle or a wave, as a particle, it's quantifiable. Whether it's space or whether it's water or whether it's fire, so, you know, fire, because that's, you know, is light, because that's fire, a wave or a particle. And there's Heisenberg's uncertainty principle and all that stuff. Is it a wave? It depends on how you look at it. From the Vedic perspective, looking at it as a particle, it is measurable. Now, question. I have a question other than your question. It's not unreasonable to say the spirit soul, which is a spark of spirit, has some measurement, but how can you measure it with material yardsticks? Because it's not material. I don't have the answer for that. Other than what I know that in Katha Upanishad, the commentary of that says, when it speaks of the super soul as being 6 inches, it sometimes speaks in the Upanishads, the super soul is 6 inches. It is Vaishnava commentary says that's to give us, it's purposeful to give us the idea of the super soul that's within the heart, which is 6 inches or the size of a thumb. Not that we should take it literally, the super soul is 6 inches, because it is immeasurable. How you can find him to 6 inches? Extrapolating, and similarly, how can the soul be finite? Whatever it is, measurable by some material dimension. Rather, extrapolated, not with scriptural authority here, but, you know, it's very tiny, but so powerful. Powerful enough to power an elephant. Powerful. And within the human form of life, powerful in a different way, not in, you know, big hulking physical form, but as brilliant as the sun and very powerful. So I don't know if I've answered your question. I think I've answered another question. But
this was a question.
Oh, that was your question. Okay. To give us some idea of infinitesimally small. That's my understanding. Although Prabhupada repeatedly referred to the verse, Keshaga Shatabhaga Shah, 1/10,000 the tip of a hair. Measurable. He never said it's figurative. Measurable. Yes.
Maharaj, this is about Buddhism. You spoke about nirvana, means nothingness.
Yes.
I'm curious to know, like, you know, what is the intention of Lord Buddha for his followers to go? What is their destination?
The destination is the river Viraja.
Like, can we understand?
You know what the river Viraja is?
Yes, ma'am.
It's neither here nor there.
Okay.
The river Viraja is a river that divides the spiritual and the material realm. So the spirit and material don't touch. There's the river Viraja. And it's neither here nor there. It's the river Viraja. It's not nothingness, but it's neither here nor there. There's no void in creation. So how do you go to a place of nothingness where there's no void in creation? You go to the river Viraja. It's neither here nor there. The sense of I'm not here, I'm not there.
Let's say there is a very sincere Buddhist follower.
Yeah, that's okay. Good.
And at the time of his death, he thinks about this nothingness, which doesn't really exist. So Krishna says, whatever you think about, that's what you attain. So what is...
Well, he attains that which he thinks he's attaining. Neither here nor there. Actually, it's more complicated. At least, you know, just like there are different brands of Christianity and Judaism and certainly Hinduism, there's different varieties of Buddhism, like a bunch of them. And the most popular one, I've done a little study, I have like, anyway, presentation on it, is, I forget, they have a name for it, something something land, pure land Buddhism or something like that. Most popular in China and in Japan today. So their teaching goes like this. If you become like, you know, really, really sincere, highly elevated practitioner of Buddhism in this life, where do you go? It's something called the pure land of bliss. And there's a form of Buddha where you get, and it's like heaven, but they don't call it heaven, it's pure land of bliss, and you get trained up to enter into nirvana. You go from somethingness to nothingness, like the best of somethingness to nothingness, because you're not really eligible for that nothingness yet, even you're like really sincere and really good. You go to that. And then from there, if you're really good, you go to nothingness. It's very strange. But you're, no, back to your question. Yam yam vapi svaran bhavam. So if, as Krishna says, and it must be true, what is it that they attain? They attain that state which they think is nothingness. Or nirvana. Break down the word. Nir means not, and vana means forest. So explicitly it means out of the forest of material existence, because you know, very strong drive in Buddhism is negation of this in various ways and ideologies and disciplines. In the different forms of Buddhism, that's like the driving force, negation of this. And where do you go? Not this. That's where you go. Nirvana, state of nirvana. I'm not this. But it's because you don't, you know, that isn't known, but it's not this, then that it's the river Viraja. That's where you go.
Just to clarify, nirvana is not wrong.
Correct. Correct. The language of the Buddhist and the language of the impersonalist are quite similar. But even in the language of the impersonalist, it's not. They don't have this sense of Brahman in the way that we do. It's more like nothingness, or the absence of this. Definition by negation. Sahotra Swami gave it like on a chalkboard in VIHE in Vrindavan, did the whole like their essence is like it, he put it down like an equation, and over there is the name and over there is a name, but the construct is just different language, but it's the same construct. That's he was illustrating that what Shankaracharya did is he won over the Buddhists by using different language than the Buddhists use, but the same conclusion, but on the authority of the Vedas. But he just brought in the authority of the Vedas, but took them to the same conclusion. So Shankara's Mayavad is not realization of Brahman. Please be clear about that. It's negation. Nirvishesha and Shudyavad are the same. Just different terms. It's not this. Yes. All the way back.
Hi, Krishna Guru Maharaj. My question is regarding pantheism.
Regarding?
Pantheism.
Pantheism.
Like one of the understanding that we get from Srimad Bhagavatam is that this level of understanding the Supreme Absolute, like those who don't have any understanding of the Supreme, they can just start with that primary
yes.
understanding
That's
of
right.
Nature. Now, the question that I was asking from our perspective, there were two thoughts coming in. One is like the instruction that we get is like when we read Srimad Bhagavatam, we should read in a very personal way.
Yes.
So that it's speaking to us.
Yes.
So when we do it in that way, what is the relevance of this understanding? I was specifically thinking in the sense like although we know the absolute truth and we understand that this understanding is incomplete, so it's not really false but incomplete, but then when we talk about knowledge and realization, sometimes I feel like from a perspective of realization, I don't have that realization to see God in nature or to see Krishna in nature.
That's okay.
So
you're not in the penalty box because of that.
And then in terms of cultivation, I feel like that's something like a very preliminary step in understanding
yes.
the Supreme.
Yes.
So how can we apply that teaching for our own cultivation?
A couple of things. One is, in the whole of creation, in the whole of the universe, and you know, in the ancient and the modern spiritual marketplace, there's this idea. So where does that fit into the whole of everything? The Bhagavatam gives it. It's as you say, it has its place. It's preliminary. For those that have no conception of God as a person, here's a beginning place. That's where. So when you hear that kind of talk, now you know where it fits. You don't have to get where does that come in? It's known, and it's preliminary. Like, you know, then demigod worship, where does that fit in? It fits in. It's not the ultimate, but it's certainly described in the Vedas. So why, if there's this supreme person? Because some people need that, because they won't just surrender to the supreme person. They have some attitude, but they want stuff, so they go to the demigods because they can get stuff. So, but it's prescribed to do that, to help elevate them. So that this, in that kind of a way, you can look at what that chapter, Canto 2, Chapter 1 is. And so, but if for you, it's not like, oh, now I've got to do that one. No, it's not you have to do that one any more than you have to do demigod worship. It's there for those who won't go any further, but they're comfortable with that one. It can help them build a conception of a personal existence of God when they have nothing. Second question. You have two questions?
No, that was the same part. So what my understanding is, when I have the understanding of Supreme as a person, so it's a subset of that. So it will come automatically with that. So
yes, if I don't, as a subset.
So if I don't have a realization right now, I don't have to worry.
Don't worry about it.
Yeah.
If you have $1 million, you can take care of your $10, $100 problems.
Mm-hmm.
Like that's Prabhupada's expression.
Mm-hmm.
It's a subset. It's already included.
Okay.
The benefit to be derived by that is included. Don't need to make a separate endeavor. It's already included. Yes.
Maharaj, then what is the destination of Mayavadis? You said Shankaracharya.
Hell.
Oh, my gosh.
Because they're offenders to the Supreme Lord. Haven't you heard that one before?
Yeah, that's
they're direct offenders. And there must be a special hell for them, because in one sense, you know, they're very self-disciplined, very strict, sense-controlled, you know, very. So there must be a special place for them. I don't know, I haven't read what that special place is.
Not actually, but I'm thinking all these days, so everything comes from Brahman, so probably they'll go back.
It's philosophized. It's true, but and what they say that it's true, but it's imagined. It's not. They're not. We make this distinction between Brahmavadis and Mayavadis. If they don't have the realization, it's just philosophized negation. And very offensive and insulting to the personal feature of God. They're like, you know, kind of cousins of Shishupal. They really don't like Krishna. Just, you know, vilify him in different ways. So, and therefore, when Prabhupada would encounter Mayavadis, he would exhibit some energy. Read, there's a chapter about that in My Glorious Master by Bhurijan. You read that? You heard about it. It's really nice. Somewhere, Hong Kong or Japan or somewhere. And Prabhupada was invited to a place where there was also a Mayavadi. So there were like two speakers. Prabhupada got there first and sat in the Mayavadi seat. And they wanted him to, oh no, this is because it was a big seat. So Prabhupada sat there. And they were trying to induce him to not sit the big seat, sit in the smaller seat. And Prabhupada wouldn't move. And then the Mayavadi came and sat. Anyway, just along, it's a very nice story. And Prabhupada spoke, and the Mayavadi spoke, and Prabhupada was like, and he just interrupted him and started, you know, bursting out with what nonsense he's speaking, got up and walked out. I couldn't take it. he was insulting Krishna. Couldn't take it. Something like that. Yes. Last question, by the way. We're going to end. It's 10 o'clock. Yes.
Going back to Lila Smaran Prabhu's
going back
question,
to where?
Lila Smaran Prabhu's question,
yeah,
about the soul. In one class I heard, this is a Prabhu from Delhi speaking, and he said that as a devotee starts spiritual, advances in spiritual practice, his soul starts expanding. Now, I'm not sure if that's a literal meaning or what. And the so related to that, I had a question.
Have you heard that one before? I've heard Prabhupada say just the opposite. That there's this idea of mahatma, and some people have the idea that regular atmas are small and the elevated souls are big. He says that's not the meaning. Mahatma is like a big soul. He got like bigger.
So my question was that I often hear there's spiritual body. So is spiritual body soul, or spiritual body has a soul as well? Or
no, it's the former.
Okay.
It's not a spiritual body, and within the spiritual body there's a spirit soul. No. The spiritual form and the spirit soul are the same. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.